Gracias por descargar este podcast de Hey Festival. Para más información sobre nuestros festivales internacionales y sobre cómo acceder a nuestro archivo, por favor visite heyfestival.org. Gracias.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you. This is like a lecture at the LSE at 9 o'clock on a Monday morning. Complete silence. So I've been told that I should introduce myself. So my name's Paul Dolan. That's my introduction done. And I've been told that I'm going to be talking about happiness. I've been asked to actually say, what is happiness? Last night I learned what happiness is. It's Cartagena rum. And I also now know what misery is, having to give a talk after drinking Cartagena rum. So I just need to manage your expectations downwards a little bit. So I am actually going to spend much of the time talking about what happiness is. I think I'm going to start, though, by just saying why we should value it, why we should measure it, and why, for policy purposes, it ought to be taken into account. Then, after having set out an account of happiness, I'll then spend a little bit of time explaining what I think the main causes of happiness are, and then maybe at the end, say a little bit about how you might make yourself happier, which might be a nice place to finish. Now, as many of you will know, Colombia is the happiest country in the world. Yeah, I know. And you should be very pleased about that. I got into the airport yesterday and immediately jumped into a taxi where the taxi driver was banging out some upbeat reggae. We had a bit of a laugh in the taxi. Then we drove past the beach and there were people playing football as the sun was coming down. And when people say to me, Colombians, how can they be so happy? There's your answer. But one of the things that we would typically look at when we're thinking about the causes of well-being more generally would be income. Now, in an economics textbook, you will find a clear definition of utility, which means well-being, satisfaction. We're not very clear about what that means, really. Is a function of income. Why? Now, the reason we say that is not because income itself matters, although it might, but it's because income allows you to be able to satisfy more of your preferences. That is, it allows you to buy more stuff. And so it's one of the reasons why GDP is used as a measure of a nation's well-being. When GDP is on the increase, people think of a nation's well-being as rising. Now, of course, that's not the only thing that we would use to indicate the success or otherwise of a nation. We have a whole range of other indicators. We look at things like life expectancy, literacy rates. And here again, you can see from that slide quite clearly that the US is doing a whole lot better. It's doing better on GDP and it's doing better on literacy rates, but not on happiness. And I think it matters that we try to explore and understand a little bit why that might be so. And so the best way I can summarize why we need happiness is to take a quote from a song by Meatloaf called Two Out of Three Ain't Bad, where he said, I want you, I need you, but there ain't no way I'm ever going to love you, so don't be sad, because two out of three ain't bad. Now, I think two out of three is bad, because most of policy for the best part of the last century has been focused on wanting, that is, satisfying people's preferences with more income, and on needing, giving people more of the things that policymakers and experts think are in people's best interests. More recently, over the last couple of decades, we've actually been able to measure much more directly the impact that people's wants and needs have on how they feel. And that's why I think it's important, ultimately, I think, that I would like policymakers and any intervention anywhere to make people feel better for longer. That's, I think, the ultimate prize for policy. So we need to inquire into something about why we get these variations. Now, a lot of philosophers disagree with me and say that there's something trivial about happiness. How can policy be concerned with something so trivial? Well, if we reframe the negative of happiness as misery or suffering, wouldn't it be rather perverse for policymakers not to want to reduce misery and suffering? I think it's incumbent on policymakers to treat people with mental health conditions, for example. That will, by definition, make them happier. Make them happier as they experience their own lives. And that's why it matters. Now, to get then to what is happiness, well, I'm going to talk about happiness as how it's been measured in most of the surveys, which include the survey that I just referred to, where your lovely nation is ranked first in the world. Most of what we know about happiness, and most of when you hear stories about, well, you know, does income make people happier? Does being married, does having children? I'll say a bit more about all those things in a second. Most of what we know about the causes of happiness come from global assessments of life satisfaction, which is asking people questions like, overall, how satisfied are you with your life? Or how happy are you these days? Very evaluative, very general questions about how well life is going. What we find from those data are a number of things. I'm just going to spend a second telling you about the age effect. Because as I now become very shortly a 45-year-old male, I will be the most miserable sex and age possible. If this is about as bad as it gets, I'm doing all right, I think, by the way. So there's a clear U-shape function of age. That is, people start off happy with the expectations of youth, and then life deals them the hand that it deals them, and they go through their 30s and 40s realizing either that they have achieved all the things that they set out to and they don't make them happy, or in most cases, they haven't achieved it and they feel frustrated. Then they probably come to terms with that by the time they're about 50, realize there's nothing they can do about it, and kind of get on with enjoying the real determinants of individual happiness. And of course, happy people are more likely to live longer, so we see an upward trend in happiness from about 50 onwards. Now, these data are all very interesting, and we could spend a lot of time talking about life evaluation questions. I don't actually think they capture what it is I would ideally like to capture, at least for the purposes of informing policy decisions, and also for informing individuals about the best ways that they can improve their own well-being. And I think we need more directly to assess the flow of people's experiences over time. That is happiness much more on a moment-to-moment, day-to-day basis. And when we do that, we do find something similar for the age effect. This is data, these are new data that we've just analyzed from the American Time Use Study. 13,000 people are asked to recall three randomly chosen episodes from the previous day, and then to say what they were doing, who they were with, and how they felt. And these are the plots of the data by age. So, as you can see, similar trend to what we find in the life satisfaction data. I'm going to talk about some important differences, though, in a second. But the account of well-being or happiness as a flow of experience over time obviously owes a lot to Jeremy Bentham. He's one on the left-hand side, by the way, if you didn't know. And more recently, to Danny Kahneman, who many of you would have heard of, Nobel Prize winner in economics, and author of Thinking Fast and Slow. I had the privilege of working with Danny for a couple of years in Princeton, and so much of what I think about most things actually is largely influenced by him. And I do think that we should be measuring happiness more directly, as I say, because one of the really important things that measuring happiness as a flow of experience over time allows us to do is to capture time use. See, because most of the time, you're not sitting there thinking, rocking in your chair, how satisfied am I with my life overall? You're going about your daily business, engaged in activities, and attending to the things that you attend to in your life. You're much more of an experience machine than you are an evaluative creature. You don't reflect often, but most often when you're asking the survey questions. Most of the time, you're going about your business paying attention to what you do and who you're with. And it seems to me that any sensible and reasonable account of happiness ought to take account of that fact, ought to take account of what we do, who we do it with, and for how long. Now, I was in Princeton in 2004, and I was thinking about whether I should have children or not. Now, if I listen to the happiness data, because of course I would like my life to be informed by what we know about the impact of these things on other people's lives, children are at best neutral. There are no data sets, or at least there were no data sets at that time that I was aware of that showed children being a positive impact on people's lives. Now, very importantly, this isn't asking people the question, how important are your children? Because, of course, the answer to that question will be, I can't imagine life without them. And that's true, of course. But it's based on data that asks people initially how happy they are, and then we find out lots of things about those people, which includes whether they have children or not. And then we can look at the impact of children along with income and marital status and all these other things on people's reports of happiness. And in those data, children are at best neutral. So it got me thinking, well, is there anywhere that children might show up in happiness? And I predicted that there might be. That most of our accounts of well-being up to that point had been based on what I might loosely call pleasure. I'm using that term to capture a whole range of emotions, of joy, contentment, of anger, of sorrow, of stress, the positive and negative emotions that go into people's experiences. And it struck me that there might be something missing from that account, that perhaps sitting alongside our experiences of pleasure and pain might be experiences of what I shall broadly call purpose. The idea that some activities that we engage in our lives, some of the experiences that we have on a moment-to-moment, day-to-day basis, bring us purpose, fulfillment. They feel worthwhile. They're meaningful. And there were no data at that point on the flow of experiences of purpose over time to sit alongside measures of experiences of pleasure over time. And so I mistakenly decided to have children, and there they are. And so having done that, I thought I'd better try and show whether they're worth it or not. Because of course they do, as anyone who's got children knows, they bring you considerable periods of misery, interjected with small moments of joy. But they do bring purpose. These are data from a paper that we published a few years ago with some, comes from a German sample of people that were asked to not just report how they felt during the activities that they were engaged in, but how rewarding was the term that we used in the paper, but they were asked to say how worthwhile those activities were. And the graph shows the relative pleasurableness of different activities on the horizontal axis, and the relative rewardingness or purposefulness of activities on the vertical axis. And you can see a few interesting things from that graph. One of the things that people will always immediately draw attention to is sex. I have to say these are German data, so you know, don't extrapolate to other countries. But one of the things one of the things that comes through from those dates, well, there's a few things that come through from those data, of course, that work is not particularly pleasurable for many people, but they do find it purposeful. But now time with kids, you see, time with kids is, you know, broadly average compared to the other pleasurable activities that people engage in, but it's somewhat more purposeful. So when I'm sitting listening to my children read to me, or when I'm reading to them, I would have more fun if I was in the pub. But I'm also experiencing purpose whilst I'm engaged in those activities. And so my account of happiness then is the experiences of both pleasure and purpose over time. And I'd like to make the substantive claim that the happiest lives are ones that have a good balance of both. To be absolutely clear, this isn't to say that they have an equal balance of both, and it isn't to say that all of us have the same balance of both. Some are more pleasure machines and others are more purpose engines, but we can all be happiest if we have the appropriate balance for our own lives. And when we look at the data again, almost all data that we've ever looked at show a U-shaped function of age. There are even recent data that show a midlife crisis in monkeys, where the keepers of the monkeys were asked to say how happy the monkeys were, and they experienced the midlife crisis. The data on purpose as an experience using those same 13,000 citizens in the US show something quite interesting. They show that there isn't that U-shape. In fact, it looks as if purpose, broadly speaking, increases with age. Now, that's pretty interesting. It suggests that there is something different and separate about experiences of purpose compared to those of pleasures and pains. What these data also allow us to do is to look much more directly at how people use their time and what the determinants of their happiness are when they're using their time in those ways. And in particular, to look at something really quite important, and that is the impact of other people on how happy you feel. Most of the time, most of us are happier when we're doing stuff with other people. But there are some interesting differences when we look at pleasure and purpose. When people are engaged in sport, it's better to be doing that with someone else on the pleasure measure. But in terms of its purposefulness, it's actually pretty neutral. And then equally, if you look at helping others, well, of course, helping others feels more purposeful when done with other people, but doesn't feel more pleasurable. So we can start digging a little deeper than these very sort of very general headline questions of how satisfied are you with your life overall, which I don't think is a useful and largely constructed question. Now, one of the things that these so that's my account of happiness. Now, I now want to turn my attention to the determinants of happiness. And one of the things, and in order to do that, I'm just going to introduce what most of the data are showing us. When you look at the impact of many events over time, there is adaptation. So in one of my favorite papers, we've set out a theoretical model of you know, basically why people, when they gain weight, aren't as miserable as people think they might be, or perhaps even ought to be. And basically, when you gain weight, you can do one of two things. You can either expend effort and energy to lose weight, or you can expend attentional energy to reduce the significance and importance of weight gain on your life. And in the data that we've looked at, it's that latter explanation that comes through quite clearly. That as people get fatter, their weight and their health and the associated determinants become less important, and they shift attention to other aspects of their life that then become more important in order to broadly maintain their level of happiness. This is an adaptation process explained by the shifting of attention. Adaptation is actually the withdrawal of attention. Now, I don't want to overstate the adaptation case because there are some conditions that are constantly attention seeking. If you're depressed and you wake up tomorrow depressed and the day after that and a year later, you're unlikely to have adapted. In fact, the data show that you don't adapt to depression. And the reason is because it is an attention seeking condition. It constantly and continually draws attention to itself. And I've used the word attention a lot, and I want to make a claim now that the determinant of happiness, is the allocation of attention. What we pay attention to in the experiences of our lives. And I'll leave you just a second to read that slide. Now, if I think the allocation of attention is crucial, and in fact, the ultimate determinant of happiness, then if we're not as happy as we might otherwise be, it's because we're misallocating attention. I apologize, this is more in the language of economics, but that's what my background and training was originally in, so I kind of tend to look for explanations that are couched in an allocation problem way. And if you think about, many of you would have read Danny Kahneman's book, and I think one of the strap lines they've used on the adverts for the book is, nothing in life is as important as you think it is whilst you're thinking about it. That's a little fortune cookie maxim for you. Nothing in life is as important as you think it is whilst you're thinking about it. Now, imagine taking a new job and you're thinking about how much happier you're going to be with the pay rise. And you think that you're going to be very happy because it's quite a considerable pay rise. Now, that would be true were you to pay attention to the pay rise in the experience of the pay rise as much as you do in imagining it. When you're projecting the impact of a pay rise on your happiness, what you're doing is you're thinking, how important is a pay rise when I'm thinking about how important a pay rise is? And when you're thinking about how important it is, it matters because you're paying attention to it. For most of the things that we experience in life, it's not just pay rises. We withdraw attention from the novelty of a changed event or circumstance and find something else to pay attention to that's new, that draws attention to itself. So if we're going to make our decisions in a way that are most likely to make us happier, we need to think about how much attention we're going to be paying to those attributes once we've made the decision, and not just when we're thinking about making it. Now, the pay rise thing is interesting because it brings in a whole range of other biases as well. So if I said to my friends and colleagues, I'm going to change jobs and it pays less money than working at the LSE, there would be quizzical and puzzled looks on many people's faces, and I'd have to go into a justification about how it's less distance to travel to work, I've got better colleagues. Of course, I love the LSE, by the way. But these more intangible aspects of that decision are more intangible, and they're the ones that then require greater justification in a kind of lay rationalism sense. Whereas if I said I'm leaving to take a better paying job, no one would dare ask a question why I would do that. So we have assumptions about our determinants of happiness, partly constructed by ourselves, partly constructed by the sort of societies that we live in, and largely determined by what we pay attention to when we're imagining the impact of that condition. So you know, as I say, it's why in most data we find adaptation. I should actually just briefly mention the marriage example. We now know that that first of all, happier people are more likely to get married, so that would help if you were happy to begin with. But there is an effect of being married on happiness, and it lasts for about 3 years. After which time, it doesn't completely wear off. There is still a residual effect. Of course, that's assuming that you don't get separated, where there is a massive negative effect of separation. Fortunately, that massive negative effect of separation is mitigated by divorce. So when you get divorced, your happiness starts rising again. And if you're lucky, you might end up somewhere back like a single person. So now, one of the serious points in that is the impact of divorce compared to separation, and that is largely explained by the resolution of uncertainty, and again captured by an attentional phenomenon. Uncertainty draws attention to itself. You're thinking about a range of consequences. Perhaps when you separate, it's, you know, will we, won't we get back together again? There's a lot of attention being directed towards the uncertainty that comes about from separation. Divorce is final. Get over it, right? And you do get over it. You start to cope by the resolution of uncertainty. This has some important lessons. So if you're faced with a negative consequence, don't actually delay facing up to the consequences of that. Your psychological immune system, as it's been called, will kick in and start to offset some of the loss that you experience from that negative outcome. Actually, most of what happens in life, not everything, and I don't want to trivialize some really serious bad events, but most of what happens in life isn't as bad as we imagine it being when we resolve the uncertainty. On the other side, of course, for the positive things, you might want to increase the uncertainty or keep the uncertainty going for longer because you've got attention being drawn to something that's quite nice to have to have its attention drawn to. So my advice to anyone who is thinking of getting married is to keep postponing the wedding. Now, I don't mean that really. You might annoy a few of the wedding guests. But you can continue to draw down this kind of anticipatory benefit of how life is going to be wonderful now you've met the perfect person without having to have those hopes and dreams dashed by the realization that maybe they're not. So there's a whole range of reasons and biases why we might misproject and mispredict what things are going to impact upon our happiness. There's also mistakes that we make. I probably could have done this at the end or at the start, but I'll do it now. I'm just reminded to thank two of my research assistants. First of all, Laura Kudrina, who has been working on the ATIS data with me, and Liz Plank, who's found these fantastic slides for me. In the experiences of our lives, we make attentional mistakes, not just in forecasting what things are going to make us happy, but as we go about our daily experiences. Now, I heard, I think, 3 phones go off whilst I was talking. Maybe more will go off in the next few minutes or so. But we are constantly having our attention drawn to our mobile devices, not always in ways that are good for us. There is now a new recognized mental condition as part of the US classification of mental addictions, which is internet addiction. Also, there's this wonderful thing called phantom vibration syndrome, which I'm sure many of you have experienced, where you have your phone in your pocket and you think you've got a text message, and you go to check and there's no one there. you've still not got any friends. or at least that's what happens to me anyway. I don't know. I shouldn't use this as a therapy session. We're constantly having our attention distracted. And distraction, again, using my attentional allocation problem, is a cost. When you switch tasks, it requires attentional energy. Paying attention to what you're doing and who you're with and turning your phone off and enjoying dinner with your friends is much, much better for you than, you know, constantly checking your phone and maybe being, you know, checking emails and everything else. But that's just more generally the case, that it's much better for us if we pay attention to what we're doing. Most of these insights are actually common sense. But it does actually drive a complete myth through this this idea of multitasking. So there was a recent study where it was a recent experiment that I quite liked, where the subjects were asked to do a Sudoku challenge and a crossword puzzle, and they could either flip backwards and forwards between the two, they could choose the order for themselves, or they could have the order chosen for them. And those who had the order chosen for them completed the task faster than the other two groups, which includes the group that chose the order for themselves. It's not surprising that the group that flitted backwards and forwards took much longer, because there were attentional switching costs from moving backwards and forwards between the puzzles. But it's interesting that the group that, in a sense, didn't have a choice about the order that they did them in, didn't do as well as those that had the order prescribed to them. And part of that may be explained by attention. You've got to think about which one to do first. Do I do the one that I'm good at, or do I save that one for last? What's the best way of doing these tasks? Well, just have it designed for you, which doesn't, by the way, and this is, I'm going to be moving on to this shortly, that doesn't, by the way, mean that other people have to design it for you. You might be able to design your environments in ways that are more conducive to you. And that's actually quite encouraging, because one of the myths of behavior change and happiness is that if only I willed myself a bit more, I could be a different person. So a lot of the advice you find in self-help books, for example, is be positive. Yeah, no shit. Like I hadn't worked that out. And of course, do you know the single biggest predictor of buying a self-help book is having bought a self-help book in the last 12 months? Because you buy a book, it tells you all these things that you should think differently, you don't achieve them, you become more miserable, and you rush out and buy another book. It's actually very difficult to change minds. It's actually very difficult to become someone else. Now, this is actually quite encouraging, because actually you don't need to become someone else. You can actually stay yourself. Now, what we've learned in the behavioral sciences over the last couple of decades, and Thinking Fast and Slow by Danny Kahneman is a really great example of bringing this work together, is that most of what we do isn't thought about, it simply comes about. We are influenced considerably by automatic and unconscious drivers of our behavior. Of course, we don't know that, because they're automatic and unconscious. We think the thinking self is making the decisions for us, because that's all we've got access to. But actually, much of what we do is driven by the environment and the situation. So, you could quite have easily, you're not paying attention to whether you've turned the oven off or not, or whether you've taken the keys out the door, or, as happened to me recently going into the LSE, or not to the LSE, I had a meeting that was going in the opposite direction on the tube train, and I got three stops towards LSE before my conscious system told me I was going the wrong way. My automatic system had started taking me to the LSE. Why? Because that's what I do, well, nearly every day when I'm in. So that's my routine. What your mind wants to do, it wants to conserve attentional energy. It's inherently lazy. And whenever it can automate a process, it will do that, and it will do it unconsciously for you. It will create an automatic process for your behavior to conserve attentional energy. Now, there's been, an increasing recognition over the last couple of decades that you can actually be maybe more effective in changing behavior through designing situations and context differently rather than by trying to change minds. Change the environments that people are in and that you yourself put yourself in rather than changing the person that you are. And so, some of you would have seen a book called Nudge by Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein. And really that's the essence of Nudge, is the idea that you change the choice architecture, is the language that they use, to make doing the right thing in some sense easier, to go with the flow of your human behavior. There are many examples in public policy of this. The most obvious example in the UK at the moment is in relation to pension policy. For a very long time, we had an opt-in pension plan, which meant that if you wanted to save for your old age, you had to actively decide to do so. Now, under the new changes, you have to opt out if you don't want to do so. So you're assumed to want to save for your old age unless you actively say otherwise. Now notice the nice thing about that architecture is you can still decide to save or not. You are at liberty to make a decision, but you're being nudged in one direction. We see the same, of course, for organ donation. If you look at countries that have opt-out organ donation, they're up at about the 90% donation rates. If you have countries that have opt-in organ donation, they're down at around 20%. That isn't explained by cultural differences across nations. That isn't explained by people's preferences over giving their organs. It's explained almost entirely by the choice architecture, by the default, by the fact that it's effortful to change. So if you can design your environment better for yourselves, consciously using the Mr. Spock system too to design the environment, you can allow your automatic unconscious system to go with the flow of your human behavior and nudge yourself happy without having to shove yourself so. One of the ways in which you might do that is to pre-commit yourself. It's a little like the Sudoku crossword case. Pre-commit yourself to doing things in a particular order or in a certain way, and you'll just be more likely to do them. You're more likely to achieve commitments if you make them public promises as well. So, you know, if you're someone that wants to lose weight, tell all your friends how you're going to do that, and then you'll feel embarrassed and whatever if you don't. You might also, one of the nice insights is to you could make a pre-commitment to give some money to an anti-charity, so, you know, to an organization that you hate, in the event that you don't achieve your targets. And then you've got the pain of having to give money to this horrible, you know, political party in the event that you don't achieve your goals. These are all ways of designing your architecture. One of the best ones around the mobile technologies, I'm kind of quite interested in mobile technologies. Largely the downsides, because there are clearly so many upsides that are obvious, there's a pre-commitment almost game that has started to emerge, mostly in the US, and I think it's called Don't Be a Dick at Dinner, which basically everyone puts their mobile phones in the middle of the table, and the first person to answer theirs or to take a text message has to buy the meal for everybody around the table. So you can design your environments in ways that just make it easier for you. Oh, you like that one. So you can design your environments in ways that make it easier for you to go with the flow of your human nature. Now, this is my... just to be sure, that was my final slide. Your happiness and your behavior is determined by what you attend to. They are both a function of your conscious attention, that is where you're deliberatively allocating attention, what you're consciously thinking about, but they're also determined by the allocation of what I'd call unconscious attention. The impact of the choice architecture, the environment, the situations, the context that you find yourself in. And importantly, your behavior and your happiness are a feedback for one another. So you might actually want to start thinking about how you pay attention to the feedback of your behavior for your happiness. I have a line in my forthcoming book, if it ever becomes forthcoming, which is lost happiness is lost forever. You know, if something is continually making you miserable by doing it, it might be a good idea to stop. And not necessarily, you know, not to kind of constantly imagine how things might be better in the future, because you've got a whole range of biases place there. So, you know, some of these insights are actually quite obvious. I'll just conclude, because I've got quite down into the individual behaviour and individual happiness. I'll just conclude by wrapping up at the more macro policy level, because public policymakers across the world, and actually the UK is a kind of leading light in this in many ways, are starting to take the measurement of happiness seriously. And we've been involved with the UK government in both thinking about what measures might be used and thinking about how policy might be influenced by looking through a wellbeing lens. And I think it's having some important impact. I think mental health conditions, for example, become much more important when you look through a wellbeing lens, when you look through a happiness lens, and I think that's how it ought to be. I think we should be reducing suffering, as I say, as people experience their lives, not as we project or imagine how they ought to be feeling. So I'm quite excited about where we're moving with happiness research. There's a long way to go, and we need to start. Obviously, I'm picking some of the causality issues as well. When we do that, it's pretty interesting that happiness is not only, well, things cause happiness, but of course, happiness causes other things. So you might, as a policymaker, not care very much about happiness. It's all a bit soft and woolly. But I do care about health, productivity, absenteeism, presenteeism. And actually, a very important lever to pull there will be happiness. It's also contagious, by the way. It's a contagious disease, misery, and I think we should be doing all we can to limit its impact and to try to, wherever possible, make people happier. Thank you very much. That's made me very happy. I see people just rushing out. I did actually try to conclude reasonably quickly if people did actually want to ask questions, but I'm completely relaxed about you not doing so. There is someone. Have you got a mic? Yeah. Do I need... Oh, I see.
I really enjoyed your talk very much. I'm a psychologist and I'm English and I'm really interested in these things. It was just a quick question. When you said paying attention is the key, have you come across any useful tips for keeping on paying attention to things that should be making you happy but you don't notice anymore? Like all my life, I wanted to have a sea view, and now I finally live with a view of the sea, and I forget to look at it. So how do people keep attending to things that make them happy?
Yeah, that's a really... I mean, I'm not going to be able to answer any of these questions fully. I mean, the sea view is really interesting. So when people think about the choice of houses, they'll often be influenced by the size. And of course, I'm going to say something that could be misinterpreted. Size is something that you get used to. And whereas a sea view, for most people, will continually draw attention to itself, because when you do look out the window, it's not quite as nice the thousandth time as it was the first, but it's not far off. So you need to, as you say, remind yourself. And I don't think, to sort of follow the theme of this talk, is actually, rather than me being very clearly prescriptive about how you should go about doing that, which typically would be, you know, remind yourself, tell yourself, try and create an environment that makes it easier for you to do that. So, I don't know, when you put your shoes on in the morning, leave them by the window that you have to look out to the sea. So, that's actually pretty good, I like that answer. So when you go and, I can answer every question. So when you go and get your shoes, you're forced to look out the window. You do it by design, not by trying to change your mind.
Aló, una pregunta.
Buenas tardes.
Perdón.
Te quería hacer un comentario de algo que sucedió en Cartagena.
Acá.
Hola. Hola. ¿Ya me escucha? Correcto. El 30 de diciembre del año que acaba de terminar, un hombre se arroja, un hombre extranjero se arroja del piso 16 de un hotel que queda contiguo a mi apartamento. Después descubro que el hombre dirigía en su país una revista que se llama Viva Feliz o Trate de Ser Feliz. Te lo digo para que tomes las precauciones que sean del caso, en tu caso particular.
Yeah, I've got that, yeah.
No deja de sorprenderme que un hombre que durante muchos años, según me pude enterar, dirigió una revista en Argentina, Viva Feliz o Trate de Ser Feliz, termine abruptamente sus días arrojado por su propia cuenta desde un piso 16. Me pregunto si ese último acto, si fuera un hecho de revancha con el mundo o con las personas o específicamente con su esposa, o constituye el último acto feliz de este pobre infeliz.
So we really should have stopped after the last question. I think it actually is quite consistent with what I'm saying, because I do think this idea of trying through force of will to be happy is going to make you miserable. I think the idea that you can kind of become someone different is actually really almost impossible. Actually, I mean, if you think about most therapies, whatever type of therapy, whatever their, you know, philosophical underpinnings, they all principally rely on acceptance. Which is just taking oneself as oneself. And then, ironically, you can then start becoming more like the person that you'd like to be once you've accepted who you are. And I think that being happier, as I say, it's just to restate what I said, rather than trying to do it through changing your mind, through force of will, by being positive, is to do it by changing your environment. Put the shoes by the window, you'll look out the window a bit more, and at the margin, you'll be a little bit happier. You haven't had to do anything except put the shoes by the window. You haven't had to think being happy. Now, why he jumped off the window, why he jumped off the 16th floor, would have been interesting to have tried to catch him on the way down to find out. But I guess there are some questions of science that we can't answer.
¿Se ha cuantificado el impacto de la religión en la felicidad?
That's a very, very interesting question. So, in the life satisfaction data, these global reports of how life is going, people of faith are generally happier than those that do not have faith. Particularly, it's very interesting, though, that people of faith in countries where either that denomination isn't the prescription of the state, or is more a kind of secular society. So if it almost appears as if you actively choose to be of that faith in a country that where that isn't the norm, that you're going to be a little bit happier. Now, I have to say that's kind of caveated by this. Most of what we know about the impact of those kind of conditions are on these evaluation questions. It'd be very interesting, and of course you expect any academic at some point to say more research is needed. In fact, more research money is needed. That's nearly always the case. But it would be very interesting to see whether, when we measure happiness as the flow of experience, as I would suggest, whether faith still comes through. I suspect it might still do on some of the purposefulness of activities. We saw it in one of the slides that I went through quickly, that religion and praying, it feels like a very purposeful thing to do.
Hi, over here. Hi. I was listening I've been listening, you know, and it's been quite interesting.
Quite interesting, yeah. Okay. That's,
And I was listening to, you know, to the things that you should pay attention, and I was looking at you, and then suddenly I looked down and I saw your socks.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you know, and I was just wondering, you know, was that on purpose? Or it's just, you know, like a way of saying, you know, I do what I want, I just, I'm gonna pay attention to anything,
well,
you know.
So that's a really interesting question, because my answer to that will be, I actually don't know. And I can give you a very deliberative, conscious, and very rational response to that question, when actually, as I say, much of what we do is driven by an unconscious process that we don't have access to. So there may be a whole plethora of reasons why I wore those socks that I don't have access to. I think it's because I think they're quite nice and they're actually quite colourful. And, you know, I quite like colourful socks.
I have a question, a quick question.
Oh yeah, where are you?
Here,
sorry.
Okay, so
okay,
I want to say that I agree completely that mobile phones are drawing attention from, you know, the present moment. My question is, what's your opinion? Is there anything we can do to influence those people? If I'm aware of that, of the attention that I'm in the present moment, but can I do something for the other people? Or are they themselves going to realize it by themselves one day? Or is there anything that we can do?
Well, it would depend how big they are. That would be my answer. If someone's bigger than me, then I probably wouldn't turn it off. If they're smaller, I'll turn their phone off. No, as a serious, that is partly serious. But as a more serious answer, I think we kind of need to, I think this is where the feedback of our happiness and our behavior really matters. Once we start paying attention to that relationship, we might start realizing for ourselves that some of what we do isn't actually making us happy, and then realize for ourselves, without others having to tell us, that we might want to change our environments a little. In the meantime, I think the idea of sort of nudging people to all put their phones, turn them onto silent, or all put them in the middle of the table is actually a pretty, you know, sensible thing that you might try with your friends.
Este es un festival de literatura, y si fuéramos a hacer una encuesta de los últimos 5 festivales que he podido yo venir, podríamos decir que el 80% de los escritores han dicho que la literatura, no escribir, sino leer, no los hizo más felices, sino que dice que los hizo un poco menos infelices. ¿Usted me puede explicar por qué los escritores dirán esto?
Oh, so here's a really challenging question. So what I would do if I was being cautious is just to say, well, we can actually look at the data. So the data on time use, again, this is why we need time use data, so that we can look at how happy people are when they're reading, when they're writing, and when they're going about these various activities. I feel a little more uncomfortable, though, because I made a kind of public announcement last night at the panel I was on that I've never read a novel. Amongst writers and literary folk, That's quite discomforting. Although I do read a lot of non-fiction, so, you know, I kind of compensate in that way. But we need to, you know, again, as a serious point of science, we need to understand causality much more. I mean, some people may actually, you know, be writers because it's a way of dealing with some misery or, you know, whatever, that is a way of kind of, you know, kind of being able to get that out. But I think the time use data help us with insights into those kinds of causalities.
Hi. Over here. My name's William Shaw. I'm actually British, born in Mexico City, and 14 years ago, I found out that Colombia is the happiest place on Earth. And I've called it my home ever since. And my question is really simple. What's the source of that data where you say Colombians are happier people?
That's a recent world poll. It's a question that asks, I had it at the beginning on the first slide. If I go back, I can't go back on the slides, but it's a world poll where, nations around the world are asked various questions. It includes questions about how optimistic they are about the future and the state of the economic system and all these things. So you can look at different rankings across different answers. It's that happiness question, as you say, that they come out first ranked on.
Okay. My question is, what role do you think compassion plays in happiness?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, see, compassion as an empiricist is a difficult concept to measure and value. So what I would alternatively do is to look at where it manifests itself. So does it manifest itself through helping others, through pro-social behaviors, through doing things that indicate that. And one of the clear insights from happiness data is that actually, you know, helping others is a really selfish thing to do because you feel really good about yourself. And again, I think getting some of that feedback, that reminding ourselves that when we're helping other people, quite aside from any impact that we might be having on them, we're having a fantastic impact on ourselves. So one of the questions might be, you know, might we or ought we to be doing more of it in order to feel that we are happier? And actually, might there be a role for governments, perhaps, in sort of nudging us to help other people more?
Can we do just one more question?
Sorry, my question is, Colombians, we are the happiest people by the statistics, but are we really answering that question deep inside, or are just the answer that we give because we are very folkloric to answer?
Yeah.
I say this because we have high rates of victims on the streets. We kill many people more than people that are in war, countries that are in war. We are not sensitive enough to people that are begging money in the streets. So are we really happy, or are we are giving the answers by saying those answers in a positive way?
Yeah.
And how do you manage to understand if this is a real answer or we are just saying it because we are so optimistic about the future?
Right. So that goes directly to my quest that we measure experiences much more, that we measure what people are doing on a moment-to-moment daily basis, rather than asking them these snapshot questions where there will be a whole range of factors and influences and sometimes biases that go into those answers. So I think those sorts of surveys are helpful in us then being able to delve deeper. I mean, it's just interesting when I put my first slide up, you know, first ranked compared to the US 31st ranked, GDP 7,000 compared to 50,000. I mean, that starts a conversation that we can then start exploring deeper. And again, the academic in me says more research is needed. We need to unpick much more about what goes into those answers, which includes understanding much more about how people use their time. I think, are we, I'm done. I think we're done. Thank you all so very, very much. Thank you.